We do have a compromise bill. There were 11 points which we discussed and went through, and we worked out 10 of the 11. The 11th one is the controversy that we're trying to address today. And in trying to settle the controversy on that 11th point, we are recommending the establishment there of the disaster fund that will allow us to pay the usual and customary charges if possible. And if not possible, then within the bill, the commissioner can make the determination of whether we should continue or to disregard the federal funds and go back strictly on a state program. But I think the point I want to emphasize right now is that the 120 days, once again, if we're going to do something, we got to do it now. The decision got to be made one way or the other.
Any further comments?
One question. Have anybody that can answer me? You said that the dentists and the doctors and everybody else has already gone on to this program. Is there something about pharmaceuticals that makes them special or would indicate that they should have some special treatment on this, or has it just been inability to get a bill through before?
We have tried three times before to get a bill through. I think you can characterize it very similar to the dentist situation. We have for a number of years real problems of moving the dentist into the program initially. We had real problems getting the dentist to sign up for the Medicaid program. We work real strongly with them around the state. We now have a good record around the state of dentists who have signed up. And then they were at 100% of charges, and we moved that 2 years ago to 75%. We did not lose a large number of dentists. We were able to work with the association. And I think this is similar in that sense, that we're moving in that direction. I understand the problem. It was the same with dentists. Initially, it is a real problem with the Medicaid program. On the other hand, it is a big savings to the state, and we feel from our standpoint that offsets the other, that we have to move in that direction and capture as many of these dollars as possible. One thing to say is that Alaska, unfortunately, given the Medicaid cap coming, has not opted to take any of the options in Medicaid. We have 8 out of 31. That's going to really hurt us when the Medicaid cap comes. And a lot of the reasons we only have 8 is because people have constantly said, well, we don't want the restrictions of these federal programs. You know, forget them, we'll fund them out of general fund dollars. And we're going to pay for that in the next few years significantly in certain areas because we chose not to take the federal dollars where we could have picked up 50 cents on the dollar. And I think this is an example where we have tried 3 times before to get a bill through and able to do that. So I think from that standpoint, I would say more of that issue than anything else.
Thank you.
Representative Duncan, Russell.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, are we ready for a motion?
If there's no further questions or debate.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, at this time I'd like to move the Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 209 from committee with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
Accompanying the fiscal note?
With the accompanying the fiscal note.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The last bill we've got is a committee substitute for House Bill number 161, an act related to interest rate and repayment provisions of scholarship loans providing for an effective date. I had earlier sent this into a subcommittee consisting of Representative Duncan, Binkley, and Rieger. Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a proposed Finance Committee substitute. First, I would like to make this perfectly clear that the prime sponsor of this piece of legislation is Representative Binkley.
Say that again? You mean the Binkley Duncan student loan?
Actually, I think we've worked on a pretty good committee substitute, however, and I want to go over it real quick. What we've done, the committee substitute is 1 page long. The original bill was about 4 or 5 pages long. One of the first things we did is take out all the data in the bill, all the material in the bill that was in House Bill 185, which has already passed the House. So we eliminated that. Second thing we deleted from the Loans Committee bill was the repeal of the forgiveness clause. The Loans Committee bill repealed forgiveness in 1990. We have deleted that from the proposed committee substitute. Now, what the proposed committee substitute does is basically three things. One, it raises loan interest rate from 5% to 8%. The current rate of 5% has been that way since 1971. Secondly, we changed the grace period, which is a period of time that you have before you start repaying the loan after you either quit school or after you graduate. The present grace period, or after you cease to become a full-time student. The present grace period is 1 year. We have delayed that grace period, or we have changed that grace period to 6 months. The reason behind that was it was our feeling that one of the better things we could do for the program was try to get money back into it quicker so that we wouldn't have to sustain it at such a high general fund level, or we could reduce the general fund level each year, and this is designed to do that. The third thing we did is we delayed the impact of increasing interest to 8% until the fourth year of loan repayment. During the first 3 years of repayment, which would be the lower income years of the borrowers, because they're just out of school getting established in jobs, they would repay as if they had a 5% loan. During the last 7 years, they would repay at a higher rate to make up for the deferred interest. It would be an 8% loan for 10 years, but the first 3 years would be payments at a 5% level. The fiscal note indicates that it's going to cost $20,000. $20,000 in fiscal year 86 to accomplish these changes. The second page of the fiscal note indicates that the positive fiscal impact off of the proposed bill will be as follows, and it has a chart there: fiscal year 86, $48,700; fiscal year 87, another $2 million. In 5 years, with these changes, we will be bringing back over $22 million more into the fund than what we would without these changes. And that's the primary purpose behind it. The third page of fiscal note shows what the level of repayment would be per $1,000. Currently, if you had a $1,000 loan, you'd pay $10.61 per $1,000 at 5%. With the delayed 8% schedule, the payment will be $10.61 for the first 3 years, and then $12.80 for the remaining 7 years per $1,000. The cumulative impact, as I said, within 5 years is $22 million. Within 10 years, we bring an additional $93 million back into the fund, and within 15 years, $186 million. We eliminated a forgiveness clause, eliminated the repeal forgiveness primarily because the fiscal impact of repealing forgiveness was very, very small. If we would have repealed forgiveness, it would have only made a difference of about $1.5 million in 10 years. We would have picked up only about $1.5 million more than what this does in a 10-year period. And it seemed that the keeping forgiveness to encourage students to come back to Alaska far outweighed the small fiscal impact of repealing forgiveness. So that's why we did not go with that. Mr. Chairman, I did not start out as an advocate of this bill. However, I think that we have worked out a pretty good compromise from what Representative Binkley started with, and probably have accomplished the major purpose, I think, of what Representative Binkley had, was to try to address some of the areas of the program which might help preserve the program on a long-term basis, and I think it's a positive step forward, and do recommend this committee substitute to the full committee.
Representative Binkley, any further comments?
No, I just appreciate the work that Representative Duncan and Rieger did in the subcommittee, and appreciate Representative Duncan's support. I might note also that although we haven't formally received them yet, many of the student union associations have indicated that they are going to support this bill as it comes out of our subcommittee. Both the Alaska Student Union Association in Fairbanks, the Student Union Association at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and the Anchorage Community College Association.
I meant to add that the Anchorage people were here in subcommittee last day, said they would support it. I think individuals from Fairbanks visited my office a couple days ago and said that they would support the committee substitute also.
Representative Bush-Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at both the March 5th fiscal note versus the April 24th fiscal note. I'm having kind of a tough time comparing those. I wonder if...
The April 25th fiscal note is the one that goes with the bill.
April 25th?
Yeah. Yes.
It should be right behind your committee substitute.
I've got April 24. 24.
Well, it should be an April 25th fiscal note.
I've got it 25th.
From Jerry Romsberg of $20,000 in fiscal year 86.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what was the figure?
$20,000.
Oh, okay.
$24,000 at the top, but I...
Okay, I'm sorry, 25th would be signed, I guess.
Okay, then if we read on across for, on capital, I guess that's what I'm having more of a problem with. Before, for example, under the original Binkley bill, 88, 89, and 90 showed, I guess, positive amounts of 56,000 rising to 349,000. I'm having trouble comparing the largeness of these numbers.
What the capital amount is, for example, if you look fiscal year 86, it has a negative figure 48.7. If you'll turn to the next page of that fiscal note, you'll see that the total impact is 48.7. That means we're bringing 48.7 back into the fund, which means we need 48.7 less in capital. We've been considering loans as capital funds, less to fund that, and that's what happens each fiscal year on out.
Okay, now maybe part of, then when at the end there, 9,69.4, is that, are we talking 9 million?
Yes.
That's the fiscal year 90. If you look at the next page explains it better. Turn it over.
Okay.
The next page is explains that fiscal note a whole lot better. It shows that in fiscal year 90, because of, based on fiscal year 86 loans, 87 loans, 88 loans, 89 loans, et cetera, we'll be bringing 9.629 back in repayment from these changes. $9 million more in repayment than we'd have if we wouldn't change anything.
Well, then, am I correct that under the new committee substitute, we're returning more money faster than under the original Binkley bill?
I'll have the original Binkley bill in front of me.
Yeah, there is some savings in the reducing the six-month grace period.
Well, that sounds like a...
Let me caution you on that. Look at the year 2000.
No, that wasn't the original. That was
Look at the year 2000 on your fiscal note. That works. Well, actually, it starts to change in the year 1996. Closing the grace period increases the repayments for the next 10, 11, 12 years, but then it starts leveling off. Because you're closing pretty quick, everybody has a closed grace period, so it doesn't bring back money faster. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, it doesn't.
The reason we started looking at the closed grace period, by the way, is the feds have gone to this. The feds now have a 6-month grace period instead of a 12-month grace period. When we originally instituted the program, they had a 12-month grace period also. So we're following the federal change.
Just one follow-up question. What would the difference of impact if we had the 8% with no phase in, just 8% for all the term of the year, which I assume is 10-year repayment terms plus an extension, I guess.
The 8% is for the full 10 years. The 8% is calculated over the full 10 years. It's just that for the first 3 years of the repayment period, you're repaying as if you had a 5% loan. And then for the next 7 years, you're repaying a higher
That's
level.
What I was hoping it was, but I wasn't
quite. Yeah.
And the difference, if you look at this one, just in the, this one that says cumulative fiscal impacts, if you just look at the scratching down here, $10.61 per thousand, that's for the first 3 years, and then $12.80 per thousand for the remaining 7 years.
They don't have that.
I think I passed that out.
Yeah. Oh, did you? Yeah, I didn't get around.
I didn't. Yeah, there, got there. Stopped over here. Yeah.
Got hung up there.
It's on Sorry. Third.
No, in this one right here.
Well, those are the same numbers right here. 1061 and 1280.
Yeah, that's, there you go. Yeah. 1061 as opposed to 1280 also.
That's on the third page of your fiscal note.
Yeah.
This was the chart I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'll pass unless you're looking for a motion to adopt the CS.
Representative Szymanski, he's gone. Yes, Representative
Rieger. I'll move that the Finance Committee adopt CS for House Bill 161, dated 425.
Fiscal note. Is there any objections? Hearing none, 161 is in the fiscal notes, moved out of committee. Representative Collins.
He who hesitates is lost.
He's got to hold the one motion.
Call the.
Does he like this version?
Finance Committee meeting to order. We've got several bills up before us today, so why don't we.
Where's he at?
Get started and run through these. The first one we've got up is HB 170, act relating to land surveys.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Szymanski.
Could I ask your indulgence to move that to the bottom of our list of consideration so that I can have an opportunity to possibly contact a sponsor?
If they don't want to show for their bills.
Well, I need.
And we're going to try and move along here.
I'm a co-sponsor in the legislation, and it's.
So am I.
As you know, it's one of those.
Representative Porcheau, you want to go with it, or you want to hold it off until we get.
I'm just going to say, slip to the bottom of the list. By that time, we can make a quick check.
Mr. Chairman, I have no problem checking. I'm unclear at this stage whether or not the sponsor supports the language that I have suggested here. I'm comfortable with this language, but perhaps Representative Szymanski's right. Maybe.
Okay, why don't we move to the bottom of the list and we'll hold off.
Okay,
the next one we want to do is HCR 20. This resolution calls for the Department of Law and Labor to prepare a report on maximizing local hire to present to the legislature next session. Department's has presented two different fiscal notes. The smaller one is assuming that HB 295 passes. The reason the funds, in addition to those in HB 295, are needed is because HB 295 only deals with collecting and analyzing data for public construction jobs, whereas this deals with all jobs in Alaska. The prime sponsor of this is Representative Pignalberry. After what he did to me this morning, I'm tempted to bury this one.
Praise the Lord.
I'll take that subcommittee, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone here to testify on HCR 20? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Landau. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Labor. I'll be very brief. We have supported this resolution and have prepared a breakdown of our fiscal note on both the $89,000 and the $69,000 version. And I've brought along our Chief of Research this afternoon in case any of the committee members have any questions about what the study is going to encompass, how it's going to be broken down, how it's going to be conducted. In general, we think it makes sense for the state to conduct an industry-wide and a statewide survey of all the industries in the state to determine and identify which industries have the highest percentages of non-residents and what the adverse impact of that is on our economy. And once that statistical foundation has been established, we feel the state is going to be in a much better position to develop policy on local hire and have those policies stand up under the current legal requirements. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, on the resolution itself. If there are any questions about the fiscal notes, I'd be happy to have our research chief answer them.
Questions? Representative Cotton?
Oh, I'd yield to the chairman of the Labor Subcommittee.
Representative Porcheau?
Yes, I did have a question, Mr. Chairman, on the fiscal note, and maybe, Mr. Lando, could you reconcile again where we are vis-a-vis 294, 295, our letter of intent that's now in the Labor Department budget, and this piece of legislation before us?
My understanding is that 294 and 295 have passed the House and are over before their first Senate committee, I believe, later on this week. This resolution was evaluated in light of 295 passing or becoming law or not becoming law. If it does become law, as it appears it will, then the actual fiscal note on HCR 20 will only be $69,000. And that has to do primarily with some economies that we'll achieve in the data entry part of the project that can be applied to both studies. These are two separate studies that have some overlap. And the study done under HB 295 will concentrate primarily on the public construction sector in an attempt to shore up the evidence in support of the current legal requirements. So it's aimed directly at the case that's now pending before the Alaska Supreme Court. We want to try to marshal all the evidence that the court has asked for to try to have that law be upheld. In contrast, the work that we would do under this resolution, HCR 20, is much broader in scope. It would look at the entire labor force in all areas of the state, in all industries, both public and private sector. We don't anticipate getting into the statistics and the numbers in the same kind of depth that we would under HB 295, but we want to conduct an across-the-board survey so that we can provide the legislature and the governor with some policy options as to how best to maximize local hire.
Mr. Chairman, now I'm going to raise the question that was raised on the last bill vis-a-vis the Labor Department budget, and I think that I'm going to use those same arguments that I defended last time for this. We, in addition, if we can keep this straight, in addition to 294, which had a fiscal note that called for enforcement people, that clearly doesn't affect this. 295 had a $100,000 appropriation to do some of this work, but another study. In the Labor Department budget, we, in addition, placed $80,000 to conduct what was described as a broader study of resident hire, which frankly, I think, even though we were talking about the kind of 295 study, could be utilized to do this purpose also. I think, Mr. Chairman, what I would propose at this time, because all of these things are kind of funneling down the pike at the same time, I don't think that we need another separate fiscal note for this at this time. And what I would suggest that at the end of this process, hopefully in a couple of weeks, we would be looking at the operating budget with this $80,000 that's in the Labor Department. We will be looking at 295 either passing or not passing. And rather than just merely canceling out, say, the $80,000 or the $100,000 appropriation at the end, we may then at that period of time, by having a zero fiscal note on this, want to go back and say in the operating budget, since we zeroed it out, and then we can go back and determine exactly how much is necessary in addition to 295 that we can play with that $80,000 in the budget. I guess my fear is, and as expressed by some members here, even on 295, we may be to the point where we're getting too many vehicles with too much money to keep track of subtracting them all at the end. And I would think it'd be...
You're asking to put this in a subcommittee for you to study for a couple of weeks?
No, Mr. Chairman, I would just suggest at the appropriate time that we move a zero fiscal note on this particular good piece of legislation, and that we will have the flexibility to incorporate additional monies in the proposed House version of the Labor Department budget if necessary.
Representative Cotton?
No, I had some questions more of Representative Porcheau, so I want to take his lead on the handling of the fiscal note here. Just because Mr. he Chairman? Seems to have a good handle of the labor budget and then the 295 question and now this one. So I'm going to be looking for a recommendation from Representative Porcheau.
Representative Szymanski?
Well, and maybe it was answered when I briefly stepped out. The concern that I have is that there's an assumption being made that between now and next year, miraculously, you're going to come back and give us some answer to some quote-unquote local hire legislation that's going to work. And I don't know what's going to change between now and next year that doesn't allow you to advance that legislation to us today. Can you respond to that?
I'll certainly try. The basic problem with most resident hire type preferences on the legal side has been that there is an insufficient factual foundation to prove to the courts that the resident preference is justified and that non-residents are coming in and displacing residents. That is the kind of factual inquiry that has to be done on an industry by industry basis. We have some industries in Alaska that we think have a high number of non-residents. We have others that have a much lower percentage. For that reason, and also because of the impact that non-residents have on our economy in terms of the wage leakage, we think it's essential to conduct an industry-by-industry study to identify those areas where non-residents are presenting a problem, and then to come up with some policy options, whether they're in the form of legislation, administrative action, or otherwise, to try and remedy the solution. Part of the difficulty, I think, with the existing resident hire requirements on public construction is that at the time that they were passed in 1983, there was an insufficient factual foundation, and for that very reason, the state ran into trouble when the law was challenged in court. And under House Bill 295, which is separate from this resolution, we are specifically going back to try to firm up some of the factual and statistical underpinnings and assumptions behind that law change 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I guess I support the concept. There's no question about it, but you still haven't, I guess I haven't got a feel for exactly what you're going to recommend and in what direction you're going. And I need an example. Maybe that'd be a better way to go.
Well, in general, the way we're going to conduct the study, first of all, we're going to try to pin down more precisely what the percentages are of residents and non-residents in every industry, in every area of the state. Secondly, we will then survey employers and employees in those industries to determine what the cause of the situation is and what possible remedies are. And thirdly, we will have a policy recommending stage at which we will evaluate the results of that survey and recommend to the legislature courses of action it could take. To give you an example, in the area of education and training, what actions the executive branch or the legislative branch could take to improve the training and linkage programs that we have now so that more residents are hired in those industries where non-residents are posing a problem. First, we have to identify where the problem areas are, and then it seems to me it makes sense to develop policy to deal with those problem areas.
Representative Ewing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that we have the sponsor, I just want to make sure I understand what the differences are between the bill that we have before us or the committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution Number 20 versus 295 and 294. And I also share the same concern while we're on the subject that Representative Pershaw is interested in, and that is that fiscal note should be included in the $100,000 study in 295, and it seems like it could be all combined into one particular area. But Mr. Chairman, through the chair, maybe the sponsor now that he's here could.
Why don't we finish testimony here first? Other questions, Mr. Landau? Thanks, sir. Representative Pinyalberry is a sponsor. I might preface it that if after this morning, I would suggest you make this relatively short and sweet if you don't want Representative Frank and I to have a subcommittee on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, the direct answer to the question about the difference between this bill and 295 is that this bill also pertains to the private sector.
Representative Boucher's bills pertain to contracts funded by state government.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it was my understanding that, as I recall the testimony that came before the Finance Committee 2 weeks ago, essentially the Department of Labor was going to go forth and audit all the records statewide, and I understand that was going to be certified payrolls. Now, that's not the same indication I'm getting from the sponsor here.
No, Mr. Chairman, if I believe in coming in late, I'm not quite in line with the line of questioning, but if I could assume, the fiscal note attached to HCR 20 is to help identify, number one, identify, number two, quantify where the non-resident hire problems are in Alaska. For example, in the packet that I believe we provided to the Finance Committee, the study that my office did, we were able to show that you have non-resident hire, great variations in non-resident hire among different industries. In the seafood processing industry, for example, it's around 60%. In the construction industry, on the North Slope, it's up around 40%. Statewide, it's 20%. So what we're trying to do here is to give the Department of Labor the money that they need to tell us how serious the non-resident hire problem is in each industry in different regions of the state. Because it is different, the solution to the non-resident hire problem will also be different. You have certain kinds of institutional barriers with the seafood processing industry and a whole different set of barriers and problems with the North Slope construction industry as opposed to the Bush construction industry. And the state does not now segregate the information in any usable way so that we can draw conclusions. They were able to, for the purpose of my study and through the House research, they were able to correlate this information based on cross-matching the permanent fund dividend database with unemployed insured people who are covered by unemployment insurance and the people who are actually drawing unemployment insurance, both in Alaska and in the lower 48. They don't do this on a regular basis, and if we're going to come to grips with the non-resident hire problem, we have to be able to keep that information going on a regular basis, and the fiscal note is for that purpose.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, could I direct a question over to Mr. Landau while he's in the audience? It was my understanding that when we had that fiscal note on 294 or 295, I don't recall which one of them it was, but however, it was my understanding there was approximately $60,000 involved in there to go out and get the records of this of the payrolls throughout the state. Now, is that are those for public construction projects, or are those specifically for private industry statewide? I thought it was for private industry statewide and public and private. I thought it was a combined.
Mr. Lando? Those payrolls are the certified payrolls that are filed only on public construction projects by contractors and subcontractors. Right now, we have that hard copy form, and what we would be doing is key entering that into a computerized database system where it could then be cross-matched with some of the other figures that we have, permanent fund records and unemployment insurance coverage records, to determine more precisely how many residents and how many non-residents we have. Those payrolls only cover public construction.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I might follow through on another question then. This particular fiscal note that we have before us is approximately, I believe, $89,000 that's shown here on page 2. However, when you're looking into the public corporations, that's like $100,000. Why is it higher for just taking a smaller segment of the industry like public construction? Here we're trying to deal with the whole industry throughout the state, and this is less.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the main reason for that is that on the public construction study under 295, we're going to be getting into much greater depth in an effort to meet the legal requirements, which thus far have been very stringent on the kind of showing that you have to make. For the study under HCR 20, it's going to be a much broader industry-wide and statewide survey of all industries.
We do not expect to get into the same kind of detail and depth that we will under the public construction survey, where we're actually going to be looking at every name on every certified payroll.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, we did, Representative Boucher's office and my office have coordinated the fiscal notes, and I don't know what information is in your packet, but we actually had two fiscal notes prepared for HCR 20. One assumed that 295 would pass and one would not. And the higher amount, of course, is if 295 did not pass. There's some economies of scale and savings, the work that would be redundant if Representative Boucher's bill was also funded. Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else testify on HCR 20? Representative Szymanski?
Thank you. I move and ask unanimous consent. We move HCR 20 out of committee with individual recommendations.
The
zero fiscal note?
Labor Commerce CS or the original CS?
We have Labor and Commerce, don't we?
Yes.
Labor and Commerce.
Representative Porcheau?
I've been trying to think about all of these pockets of money that we've scheduled around. I think one of the things to risk contradicting myself, what I said earlier, I think maybe a couple things that have come out that are a little bit different. One, that the scope of this study is considerably different or broader, you might say, than what we put in the budget. I'm worried now that perhaps we have limited the $80,000, which is contained in our Department of Labor budget. We may have, I just forget the language we put in, but I think we did, in the intent language, limit it to the legal case deal, you know, the state projects support. And I'm worried now that if in the final analysis, that may not be available to fully fund this study before us. On the other hand, I don't think the risk of duplication is really too great that we can't go back and adjust a fiscal note. But what I would recommend is that we take, and again, depending on the motion of Representative Szymanski, I would certainly recommend that we take the lower of the two figures under the assumption that 295 would pass, and under the assumption that there is room to adjust the House Labor Committee budget accordingly, as well as the final fiscal note should this bill be enacted.
I would suggest maybe at this point, if you feel it probably won't be duplication, that we go ahead and adopt the lower fiscal note and suggest that you try and go back and check on the language in the
yeah.
budget bill. And compare these. If there is duplication, we can eliminate it when the conference committee adopts fiscal notes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a reasonable approach.
Chairman, then I would amend I'd just restate my motion to include the moving labor commerce with the lower fiscal note.
Any objections? Hearing none, we'll move along CS for HCR 20.
Wouldn't read your body language that quick.
Now that we've got Representative Copeland in here, why don't we go back to 170 so he can get back down to his meeting.
You got to give me your body language a little bit. How's your reading zero? But you're saying.
That's right.
Representative Copeland, you want to go ahead and did you want to go ahead with your proposed CS first?
Mr. Chairman, maybe just to set the stage here, and then Representative Copeland can respond. Over the past several weeks, we have met with the sponsor and surveyors, DNR and BLM technical people, in trying to fashion a bill which addressed some concerns that were raised when we first had a hearing on this bill, primarily involving the question of reasonable notice prior to a surveyor entering private property. The proposed CS finance that is now in your packet on page 1 contains in subsections B and C contains language that I have recommended for a procedure under which surveyors would give reasonable notice, except in situations that would be where you have a subdivision, a surveyor is going along a rear boundary to reach the 37th lot, and he's technically stepping along the magical boundary. In those situations, that would be limited to platted subdivisions along previously surveyed lines, reasonable notice would not be required. The other change from the original bill is contained on page 2, bottom of page 2 and 3. It was my concern, I think concern expressed again by other members at the meeting, that activities that disturb or destroy a monument or its accessories may be onerous for an individual who accidentally, I think some of the, an example that was used, cuts down a tree on his private property, which may have been identified as a, quote, accessory, and that under the terms of the original bill, an individual, even non-intentionally, would be required to hire a land surveyor, resurvey a line, relocate, or re-notify that disturbance. In the CS before you, agencies would still be required to do that, but a person would just be limited to file a notice of the disturbance or destruction in the district recorder's office. The other provisions in the bill, which deal with recording of survey monumentation, is still in the bill, and I think it has a lot to commend the bill for those recording procedures. We probably should have done that years ago. But I would have to admit that there is controversy on these reasonable notice requirements, and the sponsor may want to speak to that.
Representative Kopanen?
Thank you. The last sticking point is the question of reasonable notice. What is reasonable notice? I note that it's what our lawyers and our body love to term a term of art, and is covered in the administrative code. So therefore, it is fairly tightly defined. And although this may, Section C may cover many of the surveys, we do have problems both in surveys, parcels that are incorrectly identified, or people who are under misapprehension of really where their parcel is. I remember one of my neighbors who got final proof on a house, Representative Ringstad might remember, Marshall McRoberts' cabin that he bought from Billy Miller, was located one statute mile from the description in the title deed. And so, I mean, that was the most blatant example, but I think I had five or six neighbors who did that kind of thing. The other is that the State Department of Natural Resources, and I'm sorry I didn't go into too great detail, has a policy of allowing waivers on remote parcels and various kinds of subdivisions. The problem there is then that how do you determine who is the putative owner or occupant of a parcel that you're going to survey over? And in other words, it does become difficult to adhere to all of the requirements when the information itself may be lacking. So my personal preference is that rather than in Section B, line 22 on page 1, that the land surveyor shall make a reasonable effort to notify the owner or occupant. And I'm glad that has been unacceptable to Representative Porchot, and that essentially is my position, although we have had other attempts by various people familiar with the trade to come up with other compromises. I think this is probably the last sticking point, and it's up to the committee to decide. I think both of us agree that this is an essential bill, and that whatever form it goes through, we would like to see it enacted in law, and then proceed to work on the problems that may or may not arise after that.
So you're content with the rest of the CS except for that one paragraph B then?
Yes.
Under the...
Not wholly content, but I don't believe in perfect legislation. I've never seen any.
Reasonable notice, from a surveying perspective of going out doing survey jobs from day to day, you're saying you want them to have to make a reasonable attempt to survey.
To notify. Reasonable effort.
Giving a reasonable notice.
Right. Reasonable notice can be, through the administrative code, interpreted to mean that they have to identify the people beforehand, send them out a return receipt requested kind of thing, and that's not always feasible.
Representative Larson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that was the point that I was going to try to make. To have to have a requirement that you have to contact everyone is virtually impossible, because the owner of record may not live in Alaska. They may be on vacation for a long period of time. Much of the land I know in the Mat-Su borough previously had been sold to foreigners. With the problems that they had in Beirut, I know back when I was with the borough, we had trouble contacting some of the owners who lived in that area. I suspect that we still have problems trying to get hold of them. So that I can see the gist or the reason behind, but yet there's also a practicalness that sometimes makes this impossible.
Representative Szymanski?
Okay, let me see if I understand that. The sponsor has indicated that on the proposed committee substitute on, I guess that'd be line 22, basically, and Representative Copeland, do you have a copy of it? You can kind of
yes,
follow
I do.
Along with me. That your recommendation, I'm not an English major, so it's hard for me to figure out, but it almost seems like you're saying the same thing.
The only...
And give reasonable notice and make a reasonable effort, too, and I guess Representative Ringstead touched on it. Maybe you can help me one more step further and tell me the difference between the two.
Well, if you can't identify with any absolute certainty who the owner is beforehand, or you come across an unexpected occupant, you can't give them prior notice, you know, and prove it by having sent them a return receipt requested thing or some such device which is covered in the administrative code. But if you do make a reasonable effort to notify everybody, you should have a record of that in your survey preparation or may in fact have gone to the mail out and the like.
Representative Porcheau?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to that point. Number one, there reasonable notice, if it was pressed, goes to the court. There is no definition of reasonable notice. Reasonable notice does not necessarily mean return receipt. In fact, there's a lot of kinds of notices given legally where you send the notice and you write down a little affidavit saying, I sent a notice to Joe Blow on such and such a date, and you notarize and put in the files. The guy doesn't have to acknowledge it, you just have to try to make that reasonable notice. The Beirut example, you know, that's fine. But the other example that I would use in the other extreme case is a guy is out surveying. By the way, it doesn't say, prior notice doesn't mean 2 weeks before, it can mean 5 minutes before. He goes out, he's trying to locate a line, he goes to the occupant, which is provided for, the occupant isn't home, he goes ahead, and again, this is an extreme case, he cuts a swath to follow a survey line across the guy's property to reach the back of his lot. That's the other extreme. Guy's not home, hey, I made an effort, away I go. The intent, surveyors are out working now all the time without this law. And probably in the Beirut case, they're going to go ahead and do the survey line. What we're trying to, and I'm assuming that in the Beirut case, with this law, they'll keep doing it the way they're doing it. But they may end up sending a letter to Beirut or whoever's located on the plat, as the owner of the property. But I'm uncomfortable with this effort because, again, to use the sponsor's analogy, a reasonable effort is not exactly a term of art, and that it's not a defined, who defines effort? Is, you know, you could turn the argument around the same way. I don't think this language is onerous. Some but I would admit it won't work in some cases. In the Beirut example, I mean, the practicality is it's not going to work. But it's not going to hold up the survey action any more than anybody else's.
Questions,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Zemanski?
Well, I guess to get things in perspective, what I'd like to do at this time, is, with your concurrence, is move we adopt the CS for HB 170 finance, so we have it before the committee, and then we can consider proposed amendments. So I'd so move at this
objection
time.
Objection to adopting the CS? Right, none. We have the CS before us. Are there questions for Representative Copeland? Representative Rieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. I don't know if it's for Representative Copeland or for the subcommittee members. First, what is the current common law on the right of entry of surveyors for establishing monuments and
going on? You have right of entry if you're a registered land surveyor. Because land surveyor who is entering is acting in the capacity of an officer of the state, ascertaining property title and confirming them. Even under statute, state agencies have the right to enter. The DOT does it all the time. But essentially, all of the other states either follow the common law thing, which comes back from England, the King's agent idea, or they have specific statutes allowing right of entry. They have some limits. New Mexico doesn't allow you to go down into somebody's mine and survey it without prior notice, but that's the only thing in New Mexico. All of the others have quite wide latitude. Minnesota has the tightest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And another question has to do with accessories. And as you recall, when the bill first came to the committee, I had problems with accessories. The under C on page 1, you can survey along a previously surveyed boundary, and I assume that includes going from monument to monument. Now, does that exception listed as C include access to accessories to the monument, not along the survey line?
No.
Okay, that makes me feel more comfortable with the CS. That's all I have.
President Porcello?
Let me mention one other point on what private landowners are giving up in this bill. And it may be, I don't know for a fact, but I assume Representative Copeland spoke correctly, that it is at least common practice, if not common law, for surveyors to enter on property. But if a surveyor right now does damage to the property, they are liable for triple damages under our statutes.
No, they are not.
They are. We have court suits in Anchorage. They are.
That's
liable.
Not under statute. I'm sorry. That's one of the reasons for the case. That is a point at issue. One court has found, and it's that's under a willful damage statute. In other cases, that's not finding has been thrown out. Depends on the at this point. It depends on the court it's tried before, and more especially the attorney you hire.
Let me rephrase that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
If that were true, at the top of page 2, there is no reason to include the language is liable to the landowner only for actual damages. We're trying to give the sponsor the benefit of the doubt. We're trying to clarify something that appears to be an ambiguity in existing law. If people weren't suing for triple damages, you wouldn't need this language. So we are clarifying in this law that a surveyor has the right to go on somebody's property. Should they do damage, they are only liable for actual damages. And thirdly, if the guy doesn't want him to go on the property, this bill says that under E on the top of page 2, the Attorney General may bring an action in the name of the state to restrain or prevent the obstruction of entry under A. So we at least are clarifying, and I would argue giving, some additional rights to surveyors under the terms of this bill, which in some instances I think is right. It's good. So again, I would come back, and that is why I'm in the position of suggesting that reasonable notice is not unreasonable.
On the triple damage, yeah, this doesn't remove that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. They are still responsible as any body for willful damage to the property. In other words, if a surveyor unnecessarily cuts down a tree or does other damage, they're still that they are not free of our willful damage statute, which remains inviolate. It however, Representative Porcheau is right. It clarifies the statute in that regard.
Representative Zemanski?
Yeah, for the purpose of discussion, I'd like to make an amendment to the CS before us. It'd be line 22, page 1, delete give reasonable notice.
2.
And I guess it'd be give reasonable notice 2 would be deleted. And add make a reasonable effort to notify after the word shall. Make a reasonable effort to notify.
Object.
Is that clear as to what the...
What was that again?
It would be on line 22, we would strike give reasonable notice 2, and we would insert where it was struck out, make a reasonable effort to notify.
Discussion on that? Cotton?
I'm not sure what that means, so maybe we could use an example. And it appeared to me that what Representative Porcheau originally said was, what he meant when he said give reasonable notice, he meant that you have to send the person a letter, not necessarily acknowledge, it doesn't have to be acknowledged on the other end. If somebody's in Beirut, you can send a letter to the tax recorder, the residence that's listed on the tax records. But I think I understand what that means. I'm not sure I understand what you mean when you say make a reasonable attempt, whatever your language is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could respond, my understanding based on the testimony and by the both parties involved here in their efforts to clarify this, one is if the existing language would require some time or some form of return receipt, affirmative response is my understanding.
Let me try a different approach here, Representative Copeland, you can correct me where I'm wrong. In a number of surveys, a surveyor can be hired to go do a job and be going out day after tomorrow to do this thing rather than 3 weeks from now. And in that basis, he's going to go out trying to notify the property owners, or he may give them a phone call or knock on their door or something, mailing them a letter, certified or uncertified, is pointless because he's going to be there long before the letter gets there. Is that a reasonable...
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that he just has to make a reasonable attempt. If he goes and knocks on the door of the property next door, he's attempted to do that. If they're not home, if they're out of town, he's attempted.
Right.
Whereas
there's somehow Representative Porcheau's wording implies a completion of the action and known completion of the action. It doesn't necessarily imply getting a return receipt back, but it does imply completing the action of notifying the person involved. And if you can't locate them, I don't know how you're going to do it.
Other questions? Comments? Okay, then the motion would be to delete on line 22, give reasonable notice to, and insert make a reasonable effort to notify. All in favor, show of hands. Four, all opposed. Two, three, four, five. Motion fails. Other comments? Suggestions? Mr. Porchot?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that the committee report out CS for House Bill 170 finance with individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, so ordered.
Thank you. I don't know for the record that the language I suggest is drawn from the Kentucky statutes. The existing wording doesn't exist in any of the statutes, so you're free to guess what you're voting for.
Okay, we've got another bill that we've got a sponsor that's got to get back to a meeting, as I understand it. HB 312, this bill establishes Dude Creek Critical Habitat, area in Gustavus. Which one are you looking for, Mike? 52? Okay. You're in the same spot Pinalberry was a little bit ago.
I'm ready.
You ready? You ready for a subcommittee of Mr. Frank and I?
You bet.
Oh, okay.
You're going to report out your report today, though, I guess.
Right? No. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. This is a bill with a zero fiscal note. It was brought to me for introduction by the community of Gustavus. They've worked for 3 years on it. They've got a endorsement, very strong endorsement from their community association and a committee that was set up and worked, as I say, for 3 years to establish the parameters of this critical habitat. The community wrote the language which protects the ongoing traditional uses. Apparently, there's a very large migration of sandhill cranes that stops down at a meadow in Gustavus on its way north and south, and they'd like to see that meadow protected. Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources have both provided a zero fiscal note. There is one request I would make of the committee, if you'd be willing to do so, is on page 1, line 25. I'm responsible for a clerical error where I used the word compatible in, or excuse me, the word consistent instead of compatible to describe the uses, and the department, or that is the statutes that define critical habitat, use the word compatible rather than consistent. So just for clarity, if you'd be willing to make that technical amendment, I'd appreciate it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Gall? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We've also got Mr. Ayers from the Department of Fish and Game. He just went out the door, huh?
That's okay.
That's all right.
That's all right.
Fine. The chair will entertain a motion to adopt the amendment here as Representative Gall. Hearing no objections, we'll go ahead and adopt the compatible language in line 25 there. Mr. Cotton? Yes, sir.
So moved.
Any objection to moving out the bill? That one was easy enough.
Thank you.
Mike, you're waiting to get back to a meeting, too?
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, we better get you up here, too. We're on a roll.
He voted the right way, is that?
Yeah, he voted the right bill.
Yeah, I voted.
No subcommittees on your bill. You're in good shape.
You're not sure about my vote yet.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'll see the previous witnesses, zero fiscal note, and lower him $800,000 on this one.
You got a deal.
Speaker, Mr. Cotton will remember that the last time he and I were looking across the conference table or a committee table like this, and we were talking about post-retirement retirement benefits for public employees, the bill had an $80 million fiscal note. This bill, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, in contrast, has an $800,000 negative fiscal note. Mr. Duncan and I have obviously been sharpening our pencils over the last 3 years, and we have been bringing this sort of legislation to you for some time, although never before with a zero or negative fiscal note. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to make this real fast. The situation is this. Right now, aside from what is called an ad hoc PRPA, or post-retirement pension adjustment or cost of living adjustment, aside from an ad hoc arrangement that is purely up to the discretion of the administration, if they feel that there's probably enough money to justify it, there's no protection for a lot of our old-time public employees. And this bill, by the way, just applies to public employees. It does not apply to teachers. But there is no protection against inflation for them. What happens is this, we have a lot of public employees that retired even back in the territorial days or immediately after territorial days at what was then was a pretty good retirement pension because it was based on their best 3 years as a public employee. But with the erosion that's taken place because of inflation over the years, they are now literally in poverty class, in some cases we've heard testimony over the years that they're actually on food stamps, a whole lot of bad things. And these were people, professional people, that gave their all for the territory, for the state, and because of inflation, they've just been reduced to poverty. Because of that situation, because compassion demands that the state do something about this, over the years, from time to time, the law has allowed an arbitrary 4% or up to 4% increase for these particular employees. And I certainly applaud the various administrations, Democratic and Republican, who have given those ad hoc increases. Compassion has just demanded that we do that. The good news is that they got a little bit of relief on that. The bad news is that when we do this, it puts the whole Blumen Retirement Fund out of whack because there's no actuarial basis for just saying the cost of living sure did go up, let's give them some more money. As I say, we've got to do it because, well, we've had to do it because, you know, the compassion of our hearts says we can't just let these people literally, you know, go hungry or go on relief or whatever. But it's not good business. So a number of us for years have been trying to initiate legislation that would get this out of whack trend that we ourselves are responsible for ended in the retirement system. What we've done this year with the cooperation of the Division of Retirements, Department of Administration, State, is come up with a system that will allow us to give PRPA benefits to those deserving employees who have given so much for the state of Alaska. But at the same time, it's going to pay its own way. In other words, it's going to pay its own way for several reasons, not the least of which is that the public employees who endorse this legislation and are here to testify today, as does, by the way, the administration, not the least of the fact is that the employees themselves have agreed to a very substantial increase in the contribution they will be making, as well as other sacrifices along the way. So here's what would happen, Mr. Speaker, in order to accomplish reducing this automatic PRPA and some retirement benefits for public employees as well down to zero. First of all, as you see in Section 1, we increase the withholding percentage 3%, both for the peace officer and fireman system and also for the other employees not covered by the police officers. In the case of the police officers and firemen, it goes up to 8%. In the case of the other employees, it goes up to 7.25%. The good news is that because of the new way that this will be computed, the increase won't be nearly as much as 3%. We'll be doing the same thing we do with the supplemental benefits system, and that is the reductions will be computed on the basis of the employee's compensation before computation of federal taxes. And it gets real complicated, but the net result is the employees will pay just a little bit in most instances, more, quite frankly, the federal government will be the net loser on the thing because of the way we're computing taxes, but it's all perfectly okay. We're doing it right now on the SDS system, and so the employees will be able to put in 3% more, but really their take-home pay will not be affected very much at all. Going on to Section 2, that deals with the military service. The big change that you should be aware of there, and I'm not going to go into a lot of details, is that veterans will still be eligible to claim up to their 5 years of veteran service under the PERS, except that if a person is retired military, you can't use the same 5 years in both systems. In other words, if you're getting retirement pay from the federal government, then you don't get to use those same 5 years to get retirement pay under the state government. It's called double dipping, as you're aware. On Section 7, effective date of this bill, the monthly retirement benefit for a peace officer or fireman is 2% of the average monthly compensation times the number of years credited up through 10, plus 2.5% of the average monthly compensation times the years of service over 10 years. I'll get back to that in a second if it's confusing. For the rest of the employees, it works like this: 2% of the average monthly compensation times all the years of service before July 1, 1985, for the years of service through a total of 10 years. In other words, this bill, a little further on down, is going to increase the percentile on which your retirement is based, but it's not going to be retroactive. It'll just say that from the time of passage on, for instance, if I was a public employee and had worked for 15 years, right now, the way it's computed, if I retired at age 55 and my retirement was based on a 2% percentile, I'd worked for the state for 15 years, it would be 2% times 15, my retirement would be 30% of my applicable, my best 3 years, the average of my best 3 years. Under this new computation, from now on, any new employees that finally reach 10 years, and then through their 10th through their 20th year, their percentile will be based on 2.25%. Likewise, the 15-year employer that I just discussed, using myself as an example, would, from this time on, would be able to pick up 2.25%, but it wouldn't go back and pick up, you know, the 10th through the 15th year I've already put on. It would just be the new percentile would only apply to me on the basis of my new, it would only apply from now on. Once an employee gets up to the 20-year mark, from that 20-year mark on, their percentile would be based on 2.5%. Again, though, this is not retroactive. It's somebody that's put in, say, 25 years right now, they don't get to go back and pick up at 2.5% the 20th through the 25th year. It's just that from now on, they would be picking up, they would be earning their retirement at 7.5% a year. I'm saying this so fast, if it's confusing, let me know and I'll come back to it. The guts of the bill, the reason we're doing all this basically, though, is in Section 11. That's the post-retirement pension adjustment. Now, there's two other very important things. In order to help fund this bill, and this is terribly important, for all employees hired after the effective date, the retirement age at which you can retire will be raised from 55 to 60 years. Now, anybody that's on the payroll right now are grandfathered in. That's by federal or state, I don't know which, court prior decision. It's also on the basis of fairness. In any case, all public employees now on the payroll are grandfathered in with all of the with the fact that they can retire at 55, because that's what it calls for. After this bill passes, anybody hired after this date, their retirement would be at age 60, although they could take an actuarially reduced retirement at 55. Just like right now, your retirement is 55, but you can take an actuarially reduced retirement at age 50. So there'd be a two-tiered system. And that's what a lot of employers all across the country are going to, for reasons, you know, very similar to this. For the retirees who are currently retired, and also for retirees of the future, we would at long last, and this is in Section 11, have a post-retirement adjustment. In the case of somebody who is 65 years or older, if the cost of living goes up, they would get the lesser of 75% or 9%. In other words, they would get 75% of the increase in the cost of living or 9%, whichever is smaller. Say the cost of living, of course, we're used right now to cost of living the last couple of years just going up small amounts, but you'll remember it wasn't very long ago, it was going up in double digits. So if the cost of living went up 10%, they would get either the lesser of 75%, which would be 7.5% cost of COLA, or they would get 9%, whichever is smaller. Well, obviously 7.5 is smaller in that case, so that's what they'd get. For people who are 60 years of old, at least 60, but less than 65, they would get the lesser of 50% of the increase, or 6%, whichever is smaller. And below that, there would not be a COLA. In other words, somebody retired at age 55, they wouldn't be eligible for a COLA until they hit age 60. But that's not terribly vexing, because most of the people that are retiring at 55 have retired fairly recently at a fairly substantial state job anyway, and it's not all that bad. Another change, and a big one, that reduces a huge amount of the cost of this thing is the change in the medical benefits. Again, all of the present employees who are on here would retain their present medical benefits when they retire. Right now, when you retire at any age, at 50, 55, or whatever, your medical benefits are stayed. This says a person who is younger than 60 years of age must pay an amount equal to the full monthly group premium for retirees. At least a person who is at least 60 of age but is younger than 65 must pay an amount equal to one half. And of course, people who are 65 or older, their medical benefits would be entirely paid. This is the biggest loss of benefit, if you want to call it that, I think that the employees have to contend with. But there's this to be said for it. First of all, this doesn't apply to anybody that's on the payroll right now. It'll only apply to new hires, and the new hires will be hired there with that in mind. In other words, their booklet will tell them that when they're 65, after they've worked for the state and retired and they're 65, all of their medical benefits will be paid for. From the age 60 to 65, it will tell them that they'll get 50% of their benefits, or not benefits, but 50% of the cost of the medical insurance paid for. And they'll, they'll accept the job with that as a condition. I mentioned again, just because so many employees have asked me about it, that I want to just make it real clear. Anybody on the payroll right now continues to get exactly the same retirement age eligibility, the same medical benefits eligibility, everything else that they currently get. We will be establishing a two-tiered system, though, and in the process of doing that, we reduced the cost from the tens of millions of dollars previously to an $800,000 negative fiscal note. And that's, we have Mr. Humphreys here from the Division of Retirement Benefits, if you're interested, Mr. Chairman, and as well as representatives from the APEA.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. That was kind of a quick crash course. What the intent here is, we heard HB 83 a couple days ago, that similar subject, that we have in a subcommittee with Representative Duncan, and what the idea here is to put this in the same subcommittee so he can combine the two bills and bring them back to us.
At least that's an option.
Work them together, whichever way he can come up with it.
We'll have it back.
To be back in the next day or two.
Yeah. I understood that was the policy, Mr. Chairman, and that's certainly agreeable with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Miller before
I had a question.
Yeah. Cotton?
You make it sound like it'd be crazy to pass this up.
There's a deal for you.
There's more money for the retirees, less cash out by the state, more money that the employees have to put in, yet through tax circumstances, it doesn't really cost them anymore.
Not much more. Some are going to pay a little bit more, but very little.
And what about the unfunded liability? You mentioned that.
Okay, the unfunded liability, well, this is part of the whole purpose. Now, bear in mind, a lot of the savings is the fact that this medical coverage that we guarantee fully pay into everybody who's retired regardless of their age and everything else. That's terribly expensive. So for the new hires, that's going to save us literally tens of millions of dollars over the years. In addition, the fact that we're raising the retirement age is going to save the state tens of millions of dollars over the age, over the years. But as a matter of fact, there's only one other state in the union that has an age 55 public employee retirement age. So I, you know, a bunch of us don't feel too bad about that. But now, I'm sorry, I drifted off and I didn't get right back to your question. Repeat it for me, please.
Unfunded liability.
The unfunded liability. At long last, instead of having these PRPAs, although they, even the PRPAs are grandfathered in for those who are public employees or current employees, but starting immediately, anybody that's hired will no longer have those unfunded ad hoc PRPAs, and that's what gets us out of whack actuarially. We will have this whole thing is based on actuarial soundness because we have reduced, we have done all these cost saving measures across the board here. We have actuarially allowed for a mechanism to provide the money so it'll be there for the retirees to get cost of living adjustments in the future. Right now, the reason we get so out of whack constantly is because the PRPAs that we grant are ad hoc. Nothing has been taken out in advance to cover those ad hoc cost of living increases. And as a matter of fact, nothing is taken out in the future. It's just that the system looks like it's not in bad shape. And as a matter of fact, our system, compared with other states, is not in bad shape. But it's not in good shape when we have the unfunded liabilities of the magnitude we do have.
Should we just be afraid to ask how much that is and what we're going to do about it?
I was almost afraid you'd ask because I've got such a bad memory. I can't remember, but Mr. Humphreys can give you the answer. And this would gradually, this doesn't reimburse that fund, but it gradually gets us back in whack. You know, it stops the bad trend entirely, and over a period of years, we start eating away at the percentage difference between unfunded liability and fully funded liability. But Mr. Humphreys can give you those exact figures.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Power.
Let you get back to your meeting.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Humphreys.
I'll stick around in just a minute. I always like to hear Mr. Humphreys. Mr. Speaker, while he's coming up here, let me just say, too, that this has the same salutary benefit for the covered municipalities that are in here, too. They are covered in this bill, and it's the same good news as far as negative fiscal note for them as it is for the state.
Humphreys?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Humphreys. I'm Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits. I'll be very brief. I think Representative Miller has done a good job of describing generally what the bill will do. We do support the bill. It's something that we've worked on for a lot of years. I think this is probably the best effort that's been put together. I'm pleased to see it for my own part. And with that, I would just be happy to try to answer any questions that the members of the committee may have.
Mr. Cotton, do you dare?
Is there a short answer to the question about unfunded liabilities?
Yes, there is. It would increase the unfunded liability. It will save money, but it increases the unfunded liability.
So it increases the unfunded liability. That means it makes our position even worse.
Well, I don't think so. It still
saves. Maybe I don't understand what an unfunded liability it looks. You know, I'm
I can explain that also if you like.
I thought I understood. When you say it increases the unfunded liability, it means it increases a liability that's not funded.
That's right. Right now, what the unfunded liability is the amount of money that it would take to cover the current liabilities of the system if you shut it down today, just bang, cut it off. Now, what this bill would do is it gives people on board right now rights to a post-retirement pension adjustment, which is one of the main purposes of the bill. All right, that increases liabilities. This is something that would apply, as Representative Miller said, to retirees, members that are already out of the system. This increases the existing past service liabilities. This is something that, again, as he said, we would begin funding for. It's something we're not doing right now. We're granting these post-retirement pension adjustments one by one by one, but we're not funding them. We're not assuming that we will. That doesn't happen until we actually do it. Under the terms of this bill, we would recognize that that is going to be the practice. make assumptions that are consistent with the other assumptions in the system and step up to it. That increases the liabilities, or alternately, recognizes a liability that exists. On the other hand, the bill is saving money because we're cutting the cost of future benefits by an amount more than we're increasing or recognizing past liabilities. So we have a savings influence, if you will, cutting the benefits for future employees, future retirees, in most respects, although they too would benefit from a guaranteed post-retirement pension adjustment, some assurance of what was going to happen to their benefit after retirement. At the same time, we've got this recognized liability. The two influences almost offset, but taken together, what we have is a small cost saving, small in terms of a percentage of pay, but still looking at upwards of $1 million a year in FY87.
Savings overall.
Yes.
What is the total unfunded liability of the PERS and the TRS?
Well, as of June 30, 1984, we had, June 30, 1983, the most recent figure I have here, it would be approximately $150 million in the PERS system. That is assets of $797 million, liabilities, accrued liabilities of $942 million.
That's because of these PRPAs primarily that we've already granted?
No, I wouldn't say primarily. That granting those has an influence on that.
When are we going to pay up, or what's the plan that the administration has for eliminating that liability?
Well, we are paying up every year. Every employer pays into the system not only what's called a normal cost percentage, that is, an amount to fund the benefits that are actually building up, but also what's called a past service or rate or percentage, which is an amount to amortize that particular employer's unfunded liability. We look at it on an employer-by-employer basis. So, and it's amortized over 25 years. That's a decision that was come to by the public employees and the teachers' retirement boards. The law requires that these unfunded liabilities be amortized over a period not to exceed 40 years. The boards have been slightly more conservative and gone to a 25-year, a little faster amortization. So, in fact, it is being amortized. Granting PRPAs is one influence. Legislation which improves benefits is another influence. If you have a poor investment year, that could also hinder what's called funding progress. But in general, the systems are doing pretty well, and even with the reduction in the so-called funding ratio that this bill would occasion, still the PERS system would be in very good shape, very healthy. And I think it would be very beneficial because in this PRPA influence, which tends to worsen the funding ratio, and maybe more importantly to you all as legislators, it tends to put upward pressure on the employer contribution rate. In other words, when that funding ratio goes down, absent some other influence, that past service rate that I just described that amortizes the unfunded liability over 25 years goes up. This legislation, going ahead and getting rid of these ad hoc PRPAs, repealing those sections and going ahead and getting funded ones, will tend to stabilize the employer contribution rate, not just for the state of Alaska, but for the other employers and school districts in the system. So that over time, as that unfunded liability is amortized, absent some other influence, we're going to see a declining contribution rate instead of one that's increasing. And well, I think that's a, if you will, hidden advantage.
This is sort of a re-education process for me. So my final question was, the reason we don't see the effects of retirement bills on unfunded liability is that there isn't going to be a general fund, there's not going to be a call in the general fund to satisfy those unfunded liabilities. In fact, they come straight out of the employee's paychecks. Well, and that's the plan right now, that eventually that the employees are paying off this fund, this liability.
Yes, I think that's a very accurate way to put it. The impact on the general fund is going to be positive. I mean, it will less will be paid out of the general fund.
We don't ever see a fiscal note that says, by the way, this is going to affect the unfunded liability in this fashion. Because there's never going to be a call in the general fund to satisfy that liability. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. However, in this fiscal note, it does note that there will be a decrease in the funding ratio, as I've just described, about a 10%. But there won't be any additional call on the general fund. I mean, it's set out in the fiscal note. There aren't any hidden zingers. In fact, again, if anything is hidden, it's the fact that this will remove upward pressure on the contribution rate. It's actually tends to be a savings in addition to what's already shown here.
Thank you. Boss, it's not like Social Security, and we're in good shape until we have less people working than on the retirement system.
Questions, Mr. Humphreys?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, a question just in general on the bill. There's some increased contributions by employees, and then there's some increased benefits. Do the two match? I guess, and what I'm really saying is, when you increase the contributions of certain individuals, is that providing additional benefits to certain groups of employees who have not increased their contributions?
Well, let me see where to approach that. Employees who would receive additional benefits and would not contribute more are retirees, those who are already retired. Everyone else would contribute something in addition. All the active employees, well, that is as of, I think it's January 1st, 1986, the increased contributions would go into effect. So whoever was an active employee on that date would pay additional contributions, approximately 3% from 4.25% to 7.25% with the so-called employer pickup that Representative Miller mentioned. As to how that weighs against benefit increases, generally speaking, for employees that are already on board and would be grandfathered in and not have these, for example, increases in retirement age apply to them, the benefits that they would receive in terms of potentially increased benefit formula, guaranteed post-retirement pension adjustments would much more, as a group, they would much more than outweigh the increase in their contributions. New employees, the increase in contributions, along with these other cost containment features that would apply to them, would somewhat outweigh the benefit improvements for them. So that taking those two classes as a whole, employees that are already on board will make out to some degree, new employees will suffer a small reduction, and putting those two things together, you end up with the very small, as a percent of payroll at least, savings for the state of Alaska and other employers.
Okay, I guess my question really was more directed toward some entire class of employees. I mean, this Section 1 refers to peace officer, fireman, other employee. I don't know who's left once you've covered all those. I think you mentioned teachers.
Well.
But I want to make sure there's not another group that's listed when the benefits are named farther down who's not named here. That's all I'm asking.
No, in fact, there are only two classes. This bill does not cover teachers. It covers only members of the public employees retirement system. And that within that system, there are two classes. There are the peace officers and firefighters and all others. So those are the only two, and I believe they're both addressed.
Okay, that answers that. And if I can continue, Mr. Chairman. On the negative fiscal note that you've prepared,